Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 201 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and let me introduce the co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hello, everyone. Thanks for all of the feedback as we start our climb to episode 300.
That's right. And we did get a lot of great feedback from lots of listeners on episode 200 in our 200th episode. And we saw that come in from Twitter and Facebook and email and all sorts of stuff. So we want to thank our listeners for that. Now, Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog would normally be joining us as well, but he's off. David, I don't know. Do you have any idea why Rob's not with us this evening?
Well, when I spoke to him this afternoon, he was definitely sobbing and whining completely. I think the problem is he's devastated over the loss of Dan, and I'm not sure he's going to recover. I guess we'll have to wait till be a pilot day next weekend to see if we can get him back on track.
Well, he better recover. We need him. Well, since we don't have Rob, we have a guest co-host this episode, and that is Martin Rotler.
Yay! Hi, everybody.
I think we last had you on the show in episode 169.
That is correct, way back in October.
That's right. Martin loves airline stuff. He's a licensed commercial pilot, single and multi-engine, right, Martin?
That's correct.
Got a instrument rating, and you're a CFI. And also, are you still lecturing at The Ohio State University?
I am, and will be next year as well. So I am teaching at The Ohio State University's Center for Aviation Studies. We're a small department of 275 out of 50, 60,000 students, but should be good. I teach intro to aviation, aviation history, aviation regulations, and aviation communication.
Well, that's great. We would really want to thank you for coming on the show, especially on such short notice. So we appreciate that.
Anything to help you guys out is my wonderful thing to do. So I'm glad to be here and glad to talk some news.
Great. Well, our guest this episode is Chris Anderson. Now, Chris is going to be joining us shortly. But if that name sounds familiar, it may be because Chris is a fairly interesting guy. Chris is the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, which probably most listeners are familiar with. That's a fantastic technology and lifestyle magazine. But that's not why he's joining us. Chris is also an author. Now, he's written the New York Times bestseller, The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More. This is an amazing book that caused quite a sensation when it came out, especially amongst the internet crowd, let's say. But that's also not why Chris is joining us later. You see, Chris is involved in something called DIYDrones.com. DIY, of course, standing for do-it-yourself. And this is a sort of a fascinating concept where it's a community, and the folks involved in that are really creating aerial robotics. So we're very interested in talking to Chris about that shortly. All right, we're going to start the episode with some aviation news from the past week. And then I assume, David, you have your This Week in Aviation History segment.
I do. I'm going to eliminate the history segment. We're just going to give in the topic of the airplane of the week, which is the V-22 Osprey. I think we're going to just talk about the V-22 for the segment.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. We've also got Stephen Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. They're going to bring us their Australia desk report. Peter Johnson is off this week also. He is sort of in transition and kind of without internet at the moment, so he's unable to produce a segment, but we'll have more of Peter Johnson coming up in future episodes. And we'll try a few Grill the Geeks questions. That's where our listeners send us in aviation questions. We see if we can answer them. And we've got a little bit of listener mail that we can cover. And that'll about do it for the episode. Why don't we get started with some aviation news? You guys ready?
Ready.
Ready as ever.
few articles that talk about women excelling in the U.S. Air Force. The first one is, let's see, 4th FW holds historic change of command. Now, this is a story about a woman who has assumed command of the wing, and I think she becomes, David, the first female to lead an Air Force fighter wing. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. She actually is a F-15E pilot. The 4th Fighter Wing flies F-15E Strike Eagles, or Mud Hens, whoever you are speaking to. And she is the first fighter wing commander in the United States Air Force that is female. She has over 2,500 hours in F-15E Strike Eagles and combat overseas. So it's a large step for the ladies in the Air Force, and just shows you how the glass ceiling isn't much of a glass ceiling anymore, and they're coming up through the ranks and becoming successful officers in the Air Force.
David, tell us, what does a fighter wing do?
Well, in the case of the 4th, the 4th is based at Seymour Johnson, North Carolina. They specifically fly, it's the largest F-15E Strike Eagle base in the world. There's 4 squadrons, the 334th, 335th, 336th, and 337th. The 5th, 6th, and 7th actually were originally the Eagle squadrons of the Royal Air Force in World War II, the American volunteers who fought in the Battle of Britain. They became the 4th Fighter Wing in Great Britain. The 334th is a training squadron. So as a general rule, you have one of the 4 squadrons deployed and 2 squadrons training and 1 squadron working up to deploy. And she is commanding all 4 squadrons.
Now, we also see another woman who is progressing. This is the first female 4-star general in the U.S. Air Force AFMC. That's the Air Force Materiel Command.
Yes.
And that's another, this is a lot of responsibility as well, right? This is, I think this article we have from Ohio TV.
WHIO.
WHIO in Ohio. Martin, you must know this station.
I think it's a Dayton station.
Okay. And they say that this AFMC unit has 20,000 folks in it. So this is another significant responsibility.
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is the Air Materiel Command Center. So she will be most of the operations. She will head most of the operations at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. So it's a huge endeavor. Air Materiel Command does all of the training and logistics and buying for the Air Force, for all intents and purposes. They do all the shopping, and their job is to make sure that all the airplanes have everything they need to fly. So it may not be a flying command, but it is a extremely important command in the United States Air Force.
Well, that's great. So we have these two women who are holding, you know, very positions of very high responsibility in the Air Force. And so obviously congratulations to them. David, did the Air Force make these announcements in any unusual way, or were they just made kind of in the normal manner that these kinds of things would be conducted?
Well, they were unusual in the fact of who was being promoted to these positions. However, and I think this is the way they would want it, they were standard change of commands for the 4th. It was a flag change, which is usually the term when the commanders change, as well as the promotion to 4-star they were pretty typical. And I have a feeling that the ladies who were promoted would have wanted them to be promoted in a uneventful sort of way. It should be routine Air Force procedures and nothing spectacular about it, other than it was extremely eventful that we had two within a week of each other, two prominent positions being filled by females, showing that the Air Force has really come a long way as far as that goes.
No, that's great. And I think that's the way it should be. Martin, what are you seeing in the classroom by way of the gender makeup? Are women entering aviation, at least from an educational standpoint, are they fully represented?
It is still a developing process. Right now, I would say, without having the demographic data in front of me, we are actually on a little bit of the higher end at Ohio State, maybe 30, 70, 60, 40, male to female. Mm. I know that from the last time I visited a certain giant aviation school in the south of the United States, they were right around 89-11. Wow. So, and I know that when I went to North Dakota, the aviation program itself was about between 90 and 10 and 75, 25 and 90 and 10, somewhere in there. So it's something that we can stand to involve more females in. Typically is a male-dominated field, and the more women that we can get into the field, the better, because obviously we know the rewards.
Sure. All right. Well, it sounds like the battle isn't over yet.
No, it is not.
All right. Moving on to our next item. This is from Aviation Week. China is biggest emerging threat to Boeing and Airbus, says Aubaugh. Well, the president of Boeing Commercial Airplanes says that the biggest threat to Boeing and Airbus is COMAC, the Chinese company that's looking to produce a regional aircraft, and also the larger COMAC plane that's generally a competitor to the 737 and A320 kind of class. Now, he was speaking at the Aviation Club of the UK, and he said that both Boeing and Airbus face competition from Canada, Brazil, and China. But he says, quote, "I don't believe all of them are going to be successful. My guess is one of them will emerge and become a very good competitor for us, and I won't be surprised if it was China." This is interesting. The article makes note of some of the investment that China is making in aviation. They say they have a $5 billion commitment to developing the regional jet, and also $30 billion for the C919. That's the narrow body, the 737 A320 kind of size. He said, quote, if that's going to be the airplane or not, I don't know, but eventually they will get it right. So what do you guys think? This is kind of interesting. I mean, China, we've talked about this in the past, but China is certainly making a major financial commitment to getting into this industry in a big way.
They seem to be making the investment across the board in aviation in China. From what I've heard, making some fairly big strides in general aviation, business aviation, still slow to take off, but particularly on the airline sector, they've been at the top of their game with regard to supporting investment in infrastructure and airlines. The aircraft manufacturing side of things is a fairly new investment, but I think that the government realizes, and the business people that are there realize, that it's one of those necessary industries and one of the things that makes our economy so strong in the United States and could help make the Chinese economy very strong as well.
When we had Richard Abulafia on the show, and this was some number of episodes ago, we talked about the developing industries in China and also in Russia. And his comment at the time was that he was kind of pessimistic as to this, what their success would be if they don't move away from sort of the old, you know, communist era methods for developing and manufacturing aircraft like this. And I think that's I think it was a valid point then.
I think it's still a valid point now. But what we're starting to see in the last year or so has been, as opposed to trying to go at it alone and develop it themselves, a lot of different Chinese companies have just gone ahead and bought up American counterparts. And I think that might be kind of where you see some development go in the future. If it's already there, why build it new? And there were some issues with that, I know, with the purchase of Cirrus, purchased by, I think it was COMAC. And, you know, that itself, why start a new general aviation airplane when you can just buy a company as opposed to doing that?
Yes, much easier. And all it takes is money, right?
Yep, and apparently they've got it. So it's interesting, particularly from the airplane market side of things, where the market's been going. And in the last few months, I've been paying closer and closer attention to it, particularly on the regional airline side, because that's obviously what we're more aware of, where we're sending our students who go fly. And I think what the article says about competition for Boeing, in particular from Bombardier and Embraer, is pretty true. The bigger E-jets and the C-series will be an interesting entrant to the market. It's kind of sniping at the lower end of the major airline scope, but the majors still want that bigger 120-plus seat capacity and would much rather have their regionals carry anything less than 100.
More recently, I think after the article we're citing came out, there was another article in USA Today that's titled China's Threat to Boeing and Airbus Overblown. And I thought this was kind of interesting. It says, quote, a closer examination by Reuters shows that the potential challenge from China might be greatly overblown and that its aircraft sector is unlikely to pose any credible competition for at least a decade. And I mean, that kind of resonated with me. Because developing, designing, manufacturing, a commercial aircraft, I mean, it takes years and years and years. It's a long process. And if you haven't done it before, it's an even longer process. And if you haven't done it before and sold into the worldwide marketplace, I think it's an even longer process because, it has to be established. And, as others have said, probably the initial sales will largely be centered in China for the COMAC planes, and probably, I guess, in Russia for the Russian planes, the Irkut and so forth. And I don't know. I think it could take a long time before the rest of the world feels comfortable buying an aircraft until a track record is established.
The other thing is, as far as technology transfer goes, they talk about airframes, but they're really not talking about engines. I believe the COMAC aircraft is actually using American engines on it. So I think basically there's a lot of other parts of it besides just building the airframe for them to be successful. So
yeah, that's a good point, David. The Russian plane, the Irkut, uses initially anyway the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine, and the COMAC C919 has signed up CFM International for the Leap X engine. And so you're right, they are using Western, engine technology. And I mean, we saw that with the their stealth fighter, because that plane was also believed to be flying with Russian engines, older technology Russian engines at that. So yeah, they don't have that engine technology that they really need if they want a completely indigenous aircraft.
I'm no airplane manufacturing expert, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. But I think if I were Boeing and looking at these things, I would be looking at a decade out at least, because at that point, your 737 MAX will hopefully be on the line and entering service. Your 777s and 767s will need replacements. So right. There is some kind of threat there. I don't know if it's as big of a threat as the Boeing guy says. He gets paid to kind of keep everyone's heads above the sand and trying to see.
Sure.
But the market, particularly in the next few years, as globalization comes in, particularly on the smaller side of the spectrum, will be interesting to watch with Embraer, Bombardier, the Mitsubishi regional jets,
right.
Whatever happens with Sukhoi, whatever happens with COMAC. So there's going to be a lot of interesting time ahead. And also, I think there's going to be a push for the ATR as well to come back on the turboprop side.
Well, and the other thing is, let's look at the model of Bombardier, a company that has a successful product that's trying to get into the market, and the lack of success they are currently having, and they have a benchmark to start off with. So it's... it's really going to be tough to be competitive against the big two because they've got such a big head start.
And also, even if it takes a while for the some of these other guys to get some real good traction going, that's not a good reason for, you know, the incumbents to hold off and not treat their competition seriously, because, you know, if you do that, that's the way to get your lunch eaten. All right, we have a third item. This is about the EPA and aerial photo surveillance. This article is titled, EPA Told to Come Clean on Feedlot Flyovers. So this is kind of interesting. There's something called the Clean Water Act. And one thing the Clean Water Act contemplates is livestock feeding operations. So that means, I guess, like cows and things like that. And there's the potential for animal waste, let's say, from feeding operations to run off and discharge into streams and rivers and so forth. And so the Clean Water Act has regulations that govern that. And the EPA, I guess, as I understand it, gets to administer all that. Well, how do you find out what cattle ranchers out in the U.S. West are doing and if they're following the requirements? It's difficult because there's a lot of territory to cover. So the EPA is using aircraft, you know, to surveil the ranchers and so forth. And that's causing some consternation amongst them. And they've complained about, you know, spying by the U.S. government inappropriately. I don't know. You know, I read a couple of articles about this, and I was trying to find out just, you know, what were they using? Were they using drones for this? Some of these articles in the press have photos of drones, but it's kind of hard to tell if that's what's actually doing the surveillance or if they're just kind of assuming that. I don't know. Did either of you guys have a chance to kind of understand what aircraft were being used here?
I'm working on it.
The answer is we're not sure.
I don't think it's drones, because I don't think the FAA has gotten through their processes for in allowing unmanned aerial vehicles into the national airspace system. I know that there are even the experimental areas that are out there with universities and things like that. There's still some pushback and hesitancy with that. So my educated guess would be that they're using something probably along the lines of a Cessna or a Piper product to fly low, just as any state patrol would to use airplanes to monitor speed.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a couple of things. One is that, I mean, this kind of application seems perfect for drones. That's one thing. But on the issue that the ranchers and the representatives from the states that are seeing this happen are concerned, I mean, is this really different than other forms of, you know, the police or government agencies watching people? Do you guys think that there's a different issue with UAVs and drones watching people as opposed to a cop on the side of the road?
The technology involved with unmanned aerial systems is significantly better, you'd say, than a cop watching you from the road.
Right.
So my concern with that would be that, yes, you know, the old mantra is always, if you aren't doing something wrong, then you shouldn't be worried. But, you know, the internal, like, I guess you could say, Occupy Wall Street person inside of me says that same thing should go for these other agencies that are doing things like this, to go out and use the old-fashioned and legally proven ways to surveil.
Well, I guess the argument about the policeman is you have a chance to fix your behavior when you see them. There's no, right now, for these people, there's no speed radar in their car to detect the cop or the airplane flying overhead. And there's, it's really not illegal, but there's a sense of fair play that you don't necessarily have.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think that this is going to be an issue that's going to come up more and more frequently as the use of drones increases by, you know, a variety of government agencies for a variety of different purposes. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's going to be coming up very frequently. But on the other hand, I don't think it's a whole lot different from other forms of surveillance that already occur. I mean, we have security cameras in buildings watching people. This just happens to be up in the air. Is that really different?
Well, and there's nothing in these articles that said that these were aircraft. There are these things that are called satellites, and they're really good at picking out bad people doing bad things. So, I mean, okay, they were using an airplane, but they could have done the same technology with a satellite, and then you would never really know that you were being photographed.
Our guest this episode is Chris Anderson from DIYDrones.com. Chris is also editor-in-chief at Wired Magazine. He's a co-founder of 3D Robotics, and he's also author of the New York Times bestseller, The Long Tail. Chris, are you the founder of DIY Drones?
Yeah, I am. I founded DIY Drones in 2007, and basically what happened is I was just messing around with Lego Mindstorms robotics and radio control airplanes, and said, "God, I'm sure a computer could do a better job of flying than I could." I knew nothing about the subject, but it seemed clear to me that sensors and computers and GPS, et cetera, were getting cheaper and accessible to everybody. So I did what I normally do, which is just start a site about it. And it was 2007, not 2003. So it was a social network, not a blog. And right. The rest is history.
Now, when I first ran across the website, DIYDrones.com, I was intrigued. But at first, I couldn't quite get my head around it. I mean, I wondered if this was RC airplanes with a different name. But when I saw the term aerial robotics, it started to mean a little bit more to me. Can you help us understand just what are these devices?
Yeah. So drones are basically planes with brains. They are largely radio control aircraft, planes and copters of various sorts, and also ground vehicles. But rather than being manually controlled, as traditionally they are, they're controlled by an autopilot. So they're fully autonomous, which is to say they can do automatic takeoff, landing, GPS missions, basically, give it a mission, you know, point and click on a laptop, press go, and off it goes to do its mission. You can always take over manual control if you want and return it to RC flight. But by and large, these are fully autonomous aerial robots.
Wow, that's taking this to a whole new level. Does that require a lot of expertise or training, or what does it take to be successful?
Well, it used to. It's getting easier and easier all the time. I mean, right now, the community DIY Drones, which is now 26,000 people and, you know, millions of page views a month, creates technology to make it easier. So right today, you can buy an autopilot called ArduPilot, the initials are APM2. You can buy it for about $200, $199, and it's just a box. And what you do is you just put that box in any RC aircraft, an airplane, a helicopter, quadcopter, you know, rover, anything like that, and right in between the radio control unit and the servos or motors or whatever they are, and it automatically, just that simple adding of that box makes it a drone. And it's pretty simple. You just, download some free software, onto your laptop and give it a mission, tell it what you want it to do. Huh. Off it goes.
How are people, I'm curious, how are people use? There must be competitions, right? Anytime you have things with motors and they move, people tend to make contests for them. Is it the same here?
Yeah, they're absolutely. So we have, there's about, just in our community alone, and I should mention that the community is free and an open source community where people trade ideas. Because this is, electronics at the end of the day, someone has to make it. So we also started a company called 3D Robotics that makes the autopilots and sensors and necessary equipment. So the statistics we can measure is how many autopilots are out there. And we're looking at about 14,000 just from our own company. Now, just as a kind of point of reference, that's more drones than the U.S. military. U.S. military has about 7,000 drones, and our own community has about twice that many, about 14,000 drones. Now, these drones cost on the order of, $500 all told, and the military ones start at $50,000 and go up to $50
million. Sure.
So there's a big difference in price. But in terms of performance, at least on the small one, they're pretty much designed to do everything a military one could do, minus the weapon. Aspect. So they kind of benchmarked against things like the Desert Hawk and other sort of small handheld or hand-launched drones. What the community does is, you're absolutely right, there are competitions. As a matter of fact, next weekend, or I guess it'll be this weekend if it's, when this airs, there'll be one at SparkFun, which is an electronics company in Boulder, Colorado, and they have their autonomous vehicle competition. This is, I think, the fifth annual, and a lot of the DIY drones folks will be there. We'll be having a multi-copter rodeo afterwards. But that'll be a lot of fun, and you'll see, dozens and dozens of drones in the air planes, copters, and all that. But beyond that, what people do is, it's like anything else, kind of on the bleeding edge. There's a lot of experimentation, a lot of education, a lot of doing it simply because it's cool. But increasingly, as it gets easier to use and can be used by non-experts, even non-pilots, you're seeing Hollywood using these things for photography. A lot of car commercials you see where the aerial shot is actually done by a drone. You're seeing aerial mapping. You even have personal droids where you can press a button and have a copter come out and film you kite surfing or wakeboarding or any kind of other water sports. It positions itself 15 feet behind you and above and just follows you around, keeping the camera pointed at you.
You know, a thought occurs to me, you mentioned the military applications for drones and we're familiar with those and the price and so forth, the capabilities of those. And there are also companies that are building, smaller versions for law enforcement and government agencies and things like that. Is this almost kind of like a third level, kind of a from the bottom up?
Yes, very much. Yeah.
What does that mean for sort of the commercialization of drones? Is the bottoms up group in effect beginning to produce products that, or let's say vehicles that could become products that are marketable and could be sold, generate business?
Absolutely. I mean, just to answer that last question, our company is just one of dozens of companies who are serving the kind of the hobby market. We have revenues in the, multi-millions per year. Again, sell thousands of drones per year. And there's many others. Right now, actually, the Chinese, many Chinese toy makers are making some of the most sophisticated drones we've seen. Right now, you can go to the Paris Air Show and see drones. Then you can go to the Beijing Hobby Show, 6 months later,
yeah,
and see almost identical drones. But these are aimed at hobbyists and cost under $1,000. So you're absolutely seeing a bottoms-up revolution. I think the analogy is closest to the Homebrew Computing Club. Ah. I mean, when you think about Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak in 1977 inventing the Apple, personal computer in the form of the Apple II. It wasn't that IBM scaled down the mainframe. It's that a bunch of hobbyists, scaled up some printed circuit boards and, thrown together chips. And at the end of the day, the innovation from the bottoms up, vastly exceeded, that from the top down. And, today Silicon Valley is built on that kind of bottoms up innovation model. We're exactly doing the same thing with drones. As I say, we pretty much benchmark against the military ones, but at one one-hundredth or one-thousandth the price. And we we give away the technology. It's all open source, so anybody can use it for free. And you know, it's exactly the opposite of the aerospace industry. You know, rather than, you know, highly classified, highly controlled, extremely expensive stuff that's sort of man capable, we start with super cheap stuff. We basically just take, you know, what's effectively toys, you know, radio control aircraft you can get from any hobby shop, and then just you know, upgrade their intelligence with these open source autopilots so that they essentially achieve the same missions as the military ones, but both open to everybody and at a tiny fraction of the cost.
Are there any go ahead, Martin.
Sorry. I was actually just going to ask that question. Are there any regulatory hurdles to the operation of these hobby drones in public, per se, or in populated areas?
Yeah, you know, here's the irony that the hobbyists actually have a much lighter regulatory barrier than the professionals. So my children were flying this weekend, flying drones in a local park this weekend. Lockheed Martin and, you know, and the biggest, you know, aerospace companies are not allowed to do that. There's an exemption. The FAA has rules about UAV. These are called unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. The FAA has rules about using UAVs in the national airspace. And basically, you need a certificate of authorization, which is essentially impossible to get, unless you're flying non-commercially as an amateur. In that case, you fly under the old radio control exemptions, which is under 400 feet within visual line of sight away from populated or built-up areas. So, you know, that's why there's so many more amateur drones than there are, you know, military or commercial ones, is because the amateurs are allowed to fly and the commercial and, you know, universities and other big guys aren't.
How about any safety issues? You know, have there been accidents, or what happens if, you know, there's a failure of either the hardware or the software in flight?
Yeah, so this is like, you know, again, we've had radio control aircraft for 50, 60 years, and they, you know, they crash all the time. I've crashed my share. you know, but I mean, there absolutely are failures. This is bleeding edge robotics. Lots of things, very complex devices. The software is, you know, some of the most complex. We use something called the Arduino open source platform, and, you know, the autopilot software is the most complex Arduino software ever written. Teams of hundreds of engineers combined to do this. So it is bleeding edge. It is you know, very complex. There's a lot of moving parts and things that can go wrong. But, you know, and on top of the fact that they're just radio control aircraft, which can crash for all sorts of other reasons. So that's why, again, you know, if you stay within the FAA guidelines of under 400 feet visual line of sight, so you can always take over manual control if something goes wrong, and away from populated areas, you know, the worst that typically happens is that, you know, you crash an aircraft. And we preach, you know, safety as being paramount. I mean, basically, these things, they have fail safes, they have, you know, some redundant software things, they do have efforts to try to, you know, make them as safe as possible. But fundamentally, you know, the only way to guarantee people won't be hurt is to stay away from them.
And that makes sense. How do they navigate it? Are these GPS enabled?
Yeah, so they all have GPS devices on board. You know, maybe you can include some links in the show notes. But yeah, for that, you know, that autopilot APM2, you know, for $199, what you get is basically a box, and in that box is three computers, 12 sensors, gyroscopes, accelerometers, magnetometers, barometric pressure sensors, things like that, and a GPS unit, a very small GPS unit that GPS has gotten so sophisticated, and that's how it navigates. You point and click on there's a desktop software that uses basically Google Maps, and you just point and click on it. You say, here's where I want to go, waypoint 1, 2, 3. At each waypoint, you can assign commands: loiter, take pictures, keep the camera focused on something, change altitude, maybe land or take off.
Wow.
And then when you're done, you just say press go, and it navigates via these GPS. Waypoints and all the other sensors. I should add, by the way, that all those electronics we're talking about, the embedded computers and sensors,
right,
they're basically just exactly what's in your phone. So if you have an iPhone or an Android, you've got, you know, all these gyros and accelerometers and magnetometers and compass sensors, et cetera, GPS. You've got it all in your phone. So the reason this is possible is that thanks to Apple and Android and the others, the cost of these components is falling so rapidly and the performance improving so quickly that, you know, the technology is, you know, 20 years ago, these were extremely classified, expensive, impossible to find military technologies. I have a gyroscope in front of me that I keep as a memento of that period. It's a beautiful brass machine thing, a rate gyro. This is a single axis rate gyro. The thing cost probably on the order of $5,000 each. You need three of them. That's just one of the 12 sensors, and it's a beautiful thing. And today it is just one of nine functions in a chip the size of your finger, a little fingernail.
That's
you can buy in Radio Shack, by the way.
That's incredible. I think a lot of our listeners are going to be kind of intrigued by this sort of thing. Chris, what's the path to get started in this? In terms of not just procuring the products and so forth, but learning about how to do this. What's the path that people should be thinking about?
Well, we recommend you start with planes. We recommend that you start with a foam trainer. It's a little RC plane. We think it's important that everyone who flies be able to fly manually. If need be, it's a safety factor that they can take over manual control. So we want them to be able to fly first. So we encourage them to start with a foam trainer. They cost about $70. We like one called the Bixler from Hobby King, but there's others, Easy Star and others. You can crash them. It doesn't do any damage. The prop's in the back, so you can bounce it off someone's head and doesn't even hurt. So once they can fly, then the next thing they should do is just add the autopilot, and at that point it can now fly by itself and fly autonomously, and that's a great way to get started. Very safe, very very easy to fly, easy to take over if need be. At that point, now you've got a UAV. You've got a full-on drone. You can feel good about that. Maybe put a camera on it. Maybe a video camera and with a wireless transmission, so you can do what's called first-person view, which is to say you wear video goggles and you see from the pilot's perspective, from the plane's perspective, and the plane flies by itself because it's actually quite hard to fly, through video goggles because you have no peripheral vision. So the plane flies by itself, and you get a kind of a pilot's eye view, and that's quite cool. The cool kids are really all into multicopters right now, so they're very hot, and these quadcopters or hexacopters, etc. And they're very exciting. Obviously, a fantastic camera platform because they can just hover in place. Very exotic looking. Technology looks like Skynet has become self. And so we see about twice as much interest in the copters. They're a little harder to fly, so we don't recommend people start with them, but they're getting easier, because the onboard computers can stabilize them so well. And this is the kind of thing you can take to a park and, really or your backyard and experience, real autonomy, real drones. These things will execute acrobatic missions. They'll follow geometric patterns. They'll do pretty much anything you want. They'll follow you down the street if you'd like. and that's kind of, if you want to just blow people's mind, that's the way to do it.
I think that would work. Yeah.
Chris, I'm an old school hobbyist. What does the Academy of Aeronautics say about drones? Are you tied into the radio control community? Because we always, having worked at a hobby shop for years, we always told everybody should get your membership from the Academy of Model Aeronautics, because that $10,000 worth of insurance when you crash your airplane into somebody else's house was quite useful. It would pay for your membership.
Yeah.
Are you involved with the radio community at all or no?
I am an AMA member, and we absolutely encourage people to become AMA members. A couple things stand in the way, however. First of all, drones are banned at AMA fields at the moment. I've been having good conversations with them, and I think that this will not be the case for long, but they don't allow autonomy on AMA fields. Your membership and your insurance only covers you if you're at an AMA field. The second thing is actually most of our community community, or at least maybe not most, but much of our community, doesn't actually come from the model aircraft world. They come out of the robotics world. That's why the company is called 3D Robotics. It's that people in the robotics world are looking for a new challenge, and going to the third dimension, you know, into the air, is attractive to them. So they actually, you know, one of our biggest problems is that people actually don't know anything about RC aircraft and don't know how to fly. And so we have to sometimes teach them the basics about just how RC works and how to charge a battery and things like that. But I am hopeful that the AMA will integrate drones into their policies, and I think that flying at AMA fields is a really great way to ensure safe behavior and staying away from dangerous places.
My turn. Where do you see this hobby kind of going in the next 5 to 10 years? The developments in technology and the potential developments coming out of the FAA with regards to unmanned aerial systems seem to be painting a more positive light for the incorporation of this type of technology in the airspace system. So where do you see this hobby kind of going on into the future?
Yeah, you know, I think the computer analogy is pretty apt. I mean, remember, personal computers started as something for hobbyists, and all you could really do with them was program them. And then over time, people found applications, you know, word processors, spreadsheets, and email, video games, and things like that. You know, right now, the applications, these are practical applications of drones, are generally aerial camera and video platforms, some scientific sensing. You know, that's, you know, there's some thoughts about maybe delivering things from place to place, maybe medicines in Africa, et cetera. But by and large, cameras tend to be the main one. Now, that may be the killer app for drones going forward, or it may be that something else emerges as they become more ubiquitous and more people, you know, find applications in their own world. What we do know is that the FAA has got a rulemaking procedure that in 2015, or probably a little bit late after that, there will be, you know, different classes of drones that are allowed in the national airspace for commercial purposes. And, you know, we're hoping that there will be a kind of a de minimis class, a very light and small class where it's unlikely to be able to, you know, do much damage, and that there will be a very, you know, kind of low regulatory barrier for them. And at that point, you know, we'll see. I mean, you know, what we know is that there will be lots of them out there because they're cheap and fun and accessible. It may turn out that they're nothing more, that, you know, the biggest use of them is just a kind of a fail-safe device in traditional radio control, which is that to say, you know, the aircraft can't fly away. It automatically flies home. If you get in trouble, we have something called geofencing, which is you basically draw a box, 3D box at your field, sort of say, you know, here's the X, Y, and Z areas, and the plane will not fly out of that box. So it's great for teaching kids. You basically sort of say, here, give them the controls. They can't crash it. They can dive straight at the ground, and the moment they hit the floor of that box, the autopilot will take over and bring it back to the center. So, you know, I think integrating intelligence into traditional RC, more and more camera platforms, you know, obviously border patrol, security, a lot of scientific sensing, that kind of stuff. But, you know, the truth is that anything I think of right now is going to be beaten by some idea that some kid who's going to start using it next year will come up on their own, and I'll be amazed and delighted, just like the computer.
Yeah, this is fantastic, because as you said, Chris, this offers an opportunity for a lot of creativity, just like in the early days of the, and still today, the personal computer industry. Are a lot of people writing software routines and modifying the source code?
Yeah, absolutely. That's key to the DIY drones credo. We're an open source community, which is to say we give away all the technology and all the source code is open. Specifically for that, what you find is that we provide this solid platform. Then people want more. They want to integrate a different sensor. Or they want a new function, and so they just add it. And if it's cool, we adopt into, you know, we say terrific, thank you. They add it to our repository, and we adopt in the official branch. Sometimes they, you know, half the products that 3D Robotics makes are created by the community, you know, for the community. Things like what's called on-screen display boards, which basically will integrate the data, the telemetry data, like a cockpit display into a video stream, so you can see it on the ground, in your video goggles. These are the kind of products that the community comes up with, and by creating an open ecosystem, much like the personal computer industry, all those terrific features and products and improvements that we never would have thought of our own are created by the community and given to the community for free, because that's the spirit of the place.
All right. The site is DIYdrones.com. Chris, do people find 3D robotics through that site or via a different path?
Yeah, up at the tabs at the top of the site, there's things like ArduPilot and ArduCopter, which are two of the main projects. And there's a store. That's a tab for the store up at the top. And if you go to the store tab, you're actually taken to 3D Robotics' store.
Now, at the start of the show, I mentioned that you were editor-in-chief at Wired Magazine and also author of The Long Tail. So I'll put you on the spot. We don't typically put our guests on the spot, but I think you're kind of a smart guy, so this may not really be much of a spot. But can you link the long tail concept to this idea of DIY drones?
Absolutely. Thank you for that. That's the plug. So the long tail, for those who aren't familiar with it, is basically the observation that what the internet did was, go beyond the blockbuster model of the 20th century. The blockbuster model being that, there was a small number of very powerful distribution channels called television and radio and Hollywood and, major newspapers and Walmart and things like that. And what the internet does is open up distribution to everybody. And so what you see is you still have blockbusters, but you have everything else. You have niche and products and content and entertainment that's designed for very small audiences. So YouTube is the long tail, while NBC is the short head, if you will. So that's the analogy, and it absolutely applies here. So, the aerospace industry is dominated by big aerospace companies who tend to make products that are designed for, expensive, and designed for, the biggest commercial users. There is an amateur, aviation world, and, I was at Oshkosh last year, so I've seen it. It's manned aviation. You need a pilot's license, and it's still relatively high barriers to entry. What the internet has enabled, and this notion of open source, hardware and software has enabled, is basically anybody to get involved. And what you're seeing is a kind of a long tail of aircraft. Ours are unmanned, but the same technology could be avionics in manned aircraft, you're now seeing thousands and thousands of people actually participating in the future of aviation, who don't work for aerospace companies, don't have aerospace degrees, wouldn't have otherwise passed those tests of participation, because the platform's open, their ideas can be integrated. And so you're seeing this extraordinary explosion of innovation and, new products and things that nobody would have thought of before, simply because people can do it. They have permission. The barriers to entry have fallen, and there's tons and tons. There are more people out there with good ideas than work for the aerospace industry. Now we have an opportunity to tap those.
Yeah. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you'd want to mention, Chris?
No. I mean, we could have, talked your ears off about how the technology works and, challenges of making a drone, but that's probably too technical for this call.
For our audience, it actually may not be.
So yeah, if you want to get into, how does an autopilot work? And it basically, the analogy is, it's like your brain. You've got your inner ear, which keeps you stable, knows where down is. Then you've got your sort of navigation function, where am I going? And then you've got the broader kind of artificial intelligence question, which is, what should I do next? Why am I doing this? What's my overall mission? And so those three layers, it's called the inner loop, the outer loop, and the top and the AI layer, are basically what an autopilot does. And each one of them is challenging, but that's the largely solved problems at this point.
Are those layers the same for these kinds of drones as well as any other kind of system?
Yeah,
commercial or military, is it the same?
Yeah, absolutely.
Basic
it's it they're not dissimilar from the ones that would be in a 747 or a military one. The difference being that these don't have the same layers of redundancy. They cost, you know, a thousandth or one ten thousandth as much, the artificial intelligence layer in particular is getting quite interesting. They learn, they can navigate over topology, so stay above the ground. They can stay under codes. They can find their own paths. In many ways, what you're seeing is the most advanced autopilots are actually coming out of the amateur world, because they don't have to go through the same regulatory and compliance tests as the military ones.
Sure. What an exciting area. Wow, this is cool.
We're having fun.
Yes, I can tell. The passion comes through very clearly. All right, very good. Chris Anderson, again, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate it. It's been a very insightful conversation.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Well, last time we ran the randomizer, we came up with the V-22 Osprey. And for all of those people who are complaining that there's such a thing as a randomizer, go to random.org and you will see the randomizer. But besides that, we're going to skip the history segment because we're going to talk about a topic that's fairly controversial and fairly detailed. So let's talk about the Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, the V-22 Osprey. Since the advent of the Korean War, the United States Marines have sought better ways to protect their forces from sea to the assault beach. Originally, it was by amphibious assault ships beaching. I'm partial to that method because what my father did in World War II. With the advent of the H-34 Seabat, the Marines could be deployed by helicopter a squad at a time. For the reciprocating engine-powered CH-34, it was faster than ships, but not fast enough. In 1961, the Marines started to acquire the CH-46 Sea Knight, a helicopter I'm fond of because it was built a quarter of a mile away from where I live. The Vertol CH-46 was a twin-turbine, twin-rotor helicopter, became the keystone of what has become known as vertical envelopment. And that means the Marines could project their forces not just to the beach, but beyond the beach from beyond the horizon. In 1981, the Pentagon began to look to replace the CH-46s, the then 20-plus-year-old technology, as well as other vertical lift helicopters with a newer technology. The Joint Service Vertical Takeoff and Landing Experimental Program, or JVX, was awarded development contract to Bell and Boeing Helicopters to build a larger version of the Bell XV-15 tilt rotor. The V-22, eventually named the Osprey, first flew on March 19, 1989, in the helicopter mode. The first transition to the fixed wing occurred in September 14th of the same year. Testing continued until June 11, 1991, when the number 5 prototype crashed while testing in Newcastle, Delaware. The cause of that was reversed and faulty wiring. On July 20, 1992, the number 4 prototype crashed during a press and congressional viewing at Marine Corps Air Station Quantico. 7 were killed, and that caused the grounding of the test fleet for a whole 11 months. The 11-month grounding of the fleet had Bell and Boeing simplifying the structure, reducing the weight, and trying to reduce production costs. At the same time, then, Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney was trying to cancel the program, consistently being overruled by Congress. On June 1993, the V-22B returned to flight. Flight testing continued till 1997. The Naval Air Test Center at Patuxent River received 4 full-scale development aircraft and continued operational envelope expansion. In April of that year, the first low-rate initial production, or LRIP, began. Full-rate production began in 2005. In 2012, production is to be approximately 36 aircraft a year. The Osprey testing was approximately 14 years. 2 Rolls-Royce AE-1107C turboprop engines to power the V-22B, mounted at the end of each wing. Through that wing are drive shafts that connect to a centrally mounted gearbox. This enables one engine to power both prop rotors should one engine fail. The engines are able to are on a 90-degree pivot. In 12 seconds, the prop rotors can move from the takeoff mode to the forward thrust mode, a 90-degree thing. The standard short takeoff or landing, or stall, is pitching the engines at a 45-degree angle to provide the optimal forward and vertical thrust. The engines can go seven degrees beyond the vertical to provide rearward flight. The prop rotor is three blades with a 38-foot diameter footprint. In the vertical, the props are 22 feet high. The two counter-rotating props provide the stability in the hover, with the whole wing mechanism can be folded and rotated 90 degrees to make the V-22 hangarable aboard the LAH-A class of amphibious assault ships. The folding of the rotors and tilting and swinging the wing to be hangarable takes a whopping 90 seconds. Time magazine called the aircraft unsafe in 2007 when the Marines first deployed the aircraft to Afghanistan. One of the unfortunate events in the history of the aircraft was the falsification of maintenance records at Marine Corps Air Station New River. Lieutenant Colonel Odin Lieberman and three of his fellow officers were relieved due to the scandal. Another serious issue is the loss of life involved with the program. Up and through April 2012, there have been 30 deaths associated with the aircraft. One incident in April 8, 2000, a V-22B was demonstrating an assault landing in Arizona, crashed, killing 19. The V-22 has slowly become the workhorse of the Marine Corps. It has proved itself in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. Currently, the Marines have 110 MV-22Bs in their inventory, and the Air Force has 13 CV-22Bs. One factoid is, as far as the designations go, the Marines and the U.S. Air Force have swapped designations. Usually, the Air Force for special operations aircraft have the M prefix designator. The Marines usually use the C designator. It was decided by the Navy that the switch should occur, so there was no confusion between the Osprey and the CV-22L, the USS Independence, the aircraft carrier. Why they thought that was important, I have no idea. So, one of the most important missions for the Osprey is TRAP, or Tactical Recovery of Aircraft and Personnel. Two Marine Corps MV-22Bs completed the first successful TRAP mission during Operation Odyssey Dawn, when they recovered a downed F-15E pilot in Libya. The MV-22B also has provided humanitarian assistance for the first time during the Haitian earthquakes. Now beyond the 100,000 flight hour milestone in combat areas, the V-22 has become a qualified success. Early issues with lack of defense, self-defense capabilities have been replaced by both the Special Operation Command and Marines ordering the interim defense system for BAE. The IDS brings back the ball turret to military aviation. The turret is guided by another infrared ball turret and can provide 360 degrees of defense for the V-22, providing fire suppression for assault landings. This also is supplemented by a 50 caliber weapon mounted on the rear loading ramp. Eventually, the United States Marine Corps will receive 360 MV-22Bs and the United States Air Force 50 CV-22Bs. The main difference between the aircraft is the CV-22B has an additional 900 gallons of fuel for its deep penetration special operations missions. Due to the controversies, there's only been tacit interest in the V-22. The Navy has repeatedly looked at the V-22 as a replacement for the COD or the C-2 Greyhound for COD. It would also be a two aircraft replacement for also the United States Navy currently CH-46s for their vertical ship-to-ship supply missions. Bell has also submitted the V-22 to become the replacement for the VH-3s of HMX-1, the Marine One fleet. Interestingly enough, during Barack Obama's campaign for president and when he toured Iraq, the majority of his missions were flown by on a Marine Corps MV-22B. The MV-22s are also scheduled to become replacements for the Frogs and the Super Stallions of HMX-1, the aircraft that support the Marine One mission. Lastly, overseas, the UK has had varying degrees of interest with the CV-22. Israel has had a passing interest, however, now sees the potential of the aircraft for special operations and is seriously reconsidering it. The Indian Navy is looking to purchase the aircraft with the usual required technology transfer. We're not sure that's going to happen. Also, the United Arab Emirates and Canada are looking into it for search and rescue, or SAR. Slowly, the Osprey is becoming the aircraft the Marines always wanted it to be. In this author's opinion, it'll become another aircraft that time will show had a traumatic history, only to become one of aviation's most successful aircraft. So F-104, F-111, Sopwith Camel, B-26, de Havilland Comet, say hello to your newest brother in arms. In the squadron of We Were Worth the Effort, the V-22 Osprey. And that's the way it was. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
David, that's fascinating. I have one question. What's the difference between a V-22 Osprey and just a really good helicopter? I mean, what does the Osprey offer that the helicopter doesn't?
Speed. One word answer. What the Osprey does is projects power quicker than a helicopter. It does everything a helicopter does, although when you put those rotors and you turn them into propellers, they are flying like a fast turboprop, whereas a helicopter flies is always has a maximum limit due to the fact of right, the rotor sure. blades. So the overall advantage is you have speed compared to a conventional helicopter.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Thank you, David. Are we going to run the randomizer for next week's Airplane of the Week?
No, actually, we were fortunate enough to have the art department at Thromby Air provide us an amazing cartoon for Dan's farewell. In payment for that artwork, they requested that I do a special aircraft of their choice. So next week, well, not next week, but 2 weeks from now, we will be doing the Martin M-130 Flying Boat, the original Flying Clipper. So in honor of the art department of Thromby Air, we will be having a special Airplane of the Week.
All right, very good. Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Grant, it's time for the Dateline.
Steve!
Grant, what are you doing down there?
I've fallen down the well.
Well, you need to get up here. What are you doing down that well anyway? You need to get up here and record the desk. I need the Dateline.
I was looking for the Qantas share price.
Oh, is it down there?
I think I passed it when I let go of the rope and fell. I fell past it.
Oh, what, you trip over something?
No. I was going as far as I could and I ran out of rope. So I decided to let go. I didn't think it would be that far.
Oh, dear. Oh, well, grab onto the bucket, mate, and I'll winch you up.
Yeah, okay, let it down. I'm down here with Alan Joyce's credibility.
Oh, dear. All right, here. I'm hoisting you up now.
Oh, I'm hanging onto the bucket.
Righto.
Almost there.
All right.
Oh, hi, mate.
So did you find Qantas' share price or not? It took a bit of a dip during the week.
Oh, it certainly did, mate. Certainly did. Fell below a dollar for the first time ever. I think it was something like 97 cents when I went flying past it before.
97 cents. You know, I remember a few years ago, Grant, that they had a bit of a private equity offer there, and it was, what, $5.40 or something a share they were offering?
Yeah, mate, they were offered $5.60 a share back as part of that price equity offer, which in hindsight, if they had have done it, it probably would have killed the company back then when the GFC came in and suddenly debt equity was bad. But shareholders would have been a lot better for shareholders to have gotten out then, because I tell you, mate, in the last, what, 4 or 5 days, that share price has tanked.
Okay, so what's been the cause of this? Why is it tanked? We know that they're forecasting not stellar profits, I guess, on a world scale, but yeah, it looks like their profit forecast is down significantly.
The generally held consensus was that they were going to come in around 230 to 240 million of profit this year, which while it was down on previous, still wasn't too bad. But then on the 5th of June, from left field, Alan Joyce gave his shock horror tactics that he seems to like. He's tried it with the unions, he's tried it with the customers, and now he's doing it with the shareholders, down as much as 90%. They estimate their profit will only be $50 to $100 million. They dropped this bombshell on everyone on the 5th of June, and the share price went into free fall. But the interesting bit is, mate, while the share price was plummeting, the volume was huge. Normally when a stock is not wanted and people are scared of it, the share price plummets, but there's little to no volume because no one's buying. But in this case, everyone's buying and selling. So the real question is, who's doing the buying?
Well, that's a very good question. Is it other airlines? And I mean, that's limited, I guess, by the constraints of the Qantas Sale Act, something we know that Qantas would really like to have relaxed. In fact, they were, I think, trying to get that done last year, trying to get some of those provisions changed. So, yeah, I wonder if this is part of their strategy. During the last couple of weeks, they've divided the business in half now, made long haul a separate business. And I wonder if that's part of a more longer term strategy to just prove to the world that, you know, hey, international is struggling and, you know, we need to make changes.
It could very well be. The Qantas Sale Act is more restrictive than the normal, must be less than 49% foreign owned for any international Australian based airline, which is why Virgin is separating itself out into a domestic and international. But the Qantas split is not creating separate entities. It's just creating separate reporting structures that will allow them to identify where things are going finally, which is really interesting because Alan Joyce was getting up there saying, oh, you know, the GFC, the troubles in Europe, people not flying as much, and international is really hemorrhaging money. Well, a lot of those problems, including the increase in fuel, are the same for everyone. All the airlines in the area are experiencing that. And most of them, like Singapore, Air New Zealand, and some of the other airlines, were all announcing issues months ago. Now, suddenly, the Qantas senior management have turned around and suddenly announced, oh, we're not going to make our targets. Why didn't they know? They're claiming they didn't realize they were going to do it until now. So does that mean they're incompetent or does that mean they're hiding something?
Well, interestingly here, Grant, in a statement made by Qantas Chief Executive Officer Alan Joyce, he said during the week that he expects that the international business will return to profit by 2014. Quote, we've taken decisive action to mitigate the losses by Qantas International by withdrawing from loss-making routes, reducing capital investment and transforming Qantas engineering. Now, of course, we've talked a lot about all those issues over the years. They certainly are cutting routes. In fact, I note with interest another Qantas red tail route was farmed off to Jetstar during the last month, making it even harder for Qantas long haul pilots to find any flying work. It seems to me that quite a lot of them are spending more time on the ground than they are flying these days. So, you know, I just wonder what the long term strategy is here.
Well, Qantas pulling out of routes is a great thing for all the other airlines because guess what? Singapore just increased its daily frequency to London just at the same time that Qantas is scaling it back and just at about the time of the Olympics.
Well, while investment is all a talk, Grant, over there at the Qantas Group, it's also the talk at Virgin with Etihad buying into Virgin Australia. They've acquired a 3.96% stake in Virgin Australia and the talk is they're looking to up that to 10%.
That's correct, mate. They're not going for total control. They're not going to really push the 49% because, of course, Air New Zealand's and they're owning a chunk as well. It is causing a lot of panic and scare for various angles. You've got a couple of politicians such as Senator Xenophon and the Australian Workers Union are making comments regarding the impact on Australian domestic airlines, which honestly, I think the Australian domestic airlines have their own problems and aren't really too worried about Etihad coming in and buying up all this chunk of Virgin. But it does look like a Foreign Investment Review Board inquiry is going to be triggered.
It's interesting, Grant. I wonder from a philosophical standpoint, would the travelling public really care too much if Etihad owned a bigger chunk or any other foreign carrier owned a bigger chunk of not only Virgin, but any of our airlines? I mean, is that such a big issue for people these days?
Well, some people like to say buy Australian, but, you know, we don't really see it in action. So long as people are getting good service and are happy and getting what they want, I think they just run with it.
And interesting too, according to this article that we're reading here on australianaviation.com.au, Etihad is not only investing in Virgin, but in fact, spreading its wings, if you'll pardon the pun, right around the world. It's also invested with Air Berlin, Aer Lingus and Air Seychelles. So a pretty, well, an eclectic mix, let's say that.
Yeah, it's wherever they seem to be flying, they like to get involved. Yeah, the CEO of Etihad has said he's not ruling out getting some skin in the game, i.e. having a seat on the board of directors of Virgin Australia. But right now, they're just liking to take a stake in companies they work with.
And well, James Hogan's an Australian anyway, so, you know, it's not that bad.
Well, we could always rebrand them Hogan's Heroes eventually, couldn't
we?
Oh,
good Lord. Unbelievable. Well, speaking of foreign airlines coming into Australia, we had something significant this week, Grant, and here's a bit of audio from Sydney Tower.
Scooter 2, Air Service to Sydney Tower welcomes the inaugural Scoot Airlines flight to Sydney. Threshold wind is 280 degrees, 17 knots, runway 34 left, clear to land.
Thank you, Air Service. It's great to be here. Appreciate the kind assistance. Thank you. Clear to land. Scooter 0002.
That's a lot of zeros in there, Grant.
It's interesting because the flight code was Tango Zulu 002. So I'm not sure where you got that extra zero from. Maybe he was busy aviating, navigating, and communicating was a secondary thing.
There you go. So Scoot Airlines has commenced services into Australia, the new low-cost offshoot from Singapore Airlines, using, well, not new aircraft. The aircraft, in fact, that landed here at Sydney the other day was 9 Victor OTC, Oscar Tango Charlie. And that aircraft is actually probably 10 to 15 years old. It's actually an ex-Singapore Airlines mainline fleet aircraft. In fact, it used to be 9 Victor SQC, which was in fact the third 777-212 that came into Singapore Airlines service way back when. In fact, it looks like the first three Scoot 777s in service, which are OTA, OTB, and OTC, are all ex-Singapore Airlines SQA, SQB, and SQC. And in fact, I know that SQA, I don't know about the other two, but SQA had actually been in storage over in the desert for quite some time. So they've brought that one back into service. There's a bit of airplane geekery for you, Grant.
Oh, mate, well done. Very impressive. I know you're a big fan of which serial number is which coming into the country, but for me, I just look at it and go, wow, that is a very distinctive color scheme, lots of yellow. And as some are saying, just as the flying fruit tingle may be changing its livery and getting rid of those bands of color, we get the new flying banana. Thank you, Scoot.
They need to fly up there to northern New South Wales where they have the big banana, Grant.
And the big pineapple in Queensland. Yeah, yeah, mate, there's lots of big stuff, but this is the biggest flying banana I've ever seen.
Okay, just a couple of quick ones as we finish off this week's report. Turning to military, and with apologies, David, we're going to talk tankers. Qantas has finished converting, this Qantas Defence Services, of course, have finished with the final KC-30A conversion up there in Brisbane, the MRTT, and that'll be on its way into RAF service very shortly.
Good to have it, and also interesting timing that just as that last one's being done, one of our old tankers is coming back. Yes, we've got two tanker stories, double trouble.
Yay, yay. In fact, the Omega Air Tanker, November 624, Romeo Hotel, which of course is a former RAF 707 tanker, formerly A20-64, is back in Australia and operating with the RAF, but now it's operated by the private company Omega Tanker. So even though they were sold off, they're still here, and all these years later, the 707s are still doing the job. But I suppose, well, it'd be interesting to see, actually, Grant, if they work in partnership with the KC-30A fleet or whether they're just there as a bit of a stopgap measure.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that goes. The refurbed 707 has got quieter engines as well, so that certainly helps the old 707s. You can see them coming a mile away. Massive big black clouds of smoke coming out also dragging themselves into land. Absolutely amazing to see.
Yes, nothing like turning beautifully, wonderfully clean, refined jet fuel into smoke and noise. Beautiful stuff.
Environment schmarrament. Let's have some fun.
Yes, and on that environmentally unfriendly thought, I think we'll end that off this week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm still Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Well, thanks, Steve and Grant. You know, I thought it was interesting when they were talking about foreign ownership of the domestic airlines, particularly with Etihad, you know, making some purchases. And the question was, you know, does the average flying public really care? What do you guys think? I mean, personally, if a foreign airline buys a piece of, you know, United or Southwest or something like that, do you really care?
All current laws aside,
yes. Yeah.
Would Singapore Airlines really improve United's product? Maybe. You know, I think the issue that comes from it and the reason why those laws are in place kind of refers back to the what's the program called, David, where the use of civilian airliners is included in the military's airlift capacity?
The Civil Reserve Air Fleet, the CRAF.
I think a lot of the foreign ownership rules have to deal with the need for available aircraft from domestic airlines anyways. So that's kind of a protectionist measure on ourselves. I don't think the average passenger would know. As a matter of fact, it might change up the market in itself. You know, the less pressure from the foreign carriers to charge for bag fees because they're being able to diversify their revenues around the world might be something positive. I don't know if that's something that might happen. But from a passenger perspective, I think it would just be business as usual for the most part.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, as a flyer, who owns the airline that I'm flying on, I don't think I care that much. Not really.
Well, but do you care about – I mean, okay, we're not talking ownership, but the alliance is ownership. They want you go from one airline to another and not leave their universe. So you may not have foreign ownership, but you do have control and manipulation by the alliances.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, there's some influence there.
When you take it a step further to joint ventures as well, like what you see across the pond with Delta, Air France, KLM, American and British Airways, and United and Lufthansa, where now you market a flight, and no matter where the passenger buys the ticket, whether it be off of Lufthansa.com or United.com, half of the airlines are getting, or half of each fare is given to each airline. So in a sense, they've been able to circumvent that a little bit on the international side of the spectrum.
The
domestic ownership rules still apply.
Yeah, the rule applies. If Lufthansa took a equity position in United, it wouldn't bother me. Okay, now it's time for Grill the Geeks. And again, this is our segment where listeners send in questions and try to stump us. So we've got a couple. Martin, you can obviously play along. In fact, we probably will need you.
I highly recommend it because I ain't I'm not going to do this alone anymore.
Well, it depends on the questions. All right, here's the first question. This comes from Jeremy. He says, when NASA bought the Boeing 747-100s to carry the shuttles, one of them was from American Airlines. What was the other airline? So these are 747-100s. I'm going to guess United.
I would guess Eastern. No, it wouldn't be Eastern. I would say Pan Am.
I know, David, do you know the answer to this, or are you just going to keep quiet anyway?
No, I'm actually trying to think. American was the first one. The second one I thought, though, was a freighter. So that's what, and off the top of my head, I don't know. But I'm pretty sure the American Airlines one was actually the one that ferried Discovery and Enterprise. She's the only one. The other one, though, was, I'm 99% sure it was a freighter. So I'm not sure what airline she was from.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of guesses, but we don't have a real solid guess, it sounds like. But maybe we're right, though. Maybe we guessed correctly. Maybe someone did. Probably Martin. All right, let's take a look at the answer. You guys ready for the answer?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me open this up.
Bring it on.
Okay, from Jeremy. Okay. Nope, we're not right. We didn't get it. He says, the other 747-100 was a 747-100SR from Japan Airlines. So, yeah, no, that was a good question. All right, Jeremy, you got us. All right, let's see if there's, let's see if we got another one. Let's see. This one is from Matthew. It goes by Airstig. He's from Australia. Now, we get a lot of tough questions from Australia. All right, here's his question. How many airframe manufacturers does Textron wholly own, and name them? He says, I think the answer may surprise you. How many airframe manufacturers does Textron wholly own, and name them?
Bell.
They own Bell Helicopter.
Cessna.
Yeah, I knew. Yeah, any other GA? Just Cessna, right?
I think Cessna's the only one.
Yeah. Any others? What else does Textron own? What about military?
Bell Helicopters.
Yeah, yeah. But anything else? All right. Is that our answer? Bell Helicopter and Cessna?
That's my final answer.
He said framers, right?
Yes. How many airframe manufacturers?
Okay, because I know I'm pretty sure that Textron owns Lycoming too.
Oh,
but that's engines. That's not airframes.
That's right. All right, so let's see what Matthew has here. Let's see. Open up the answer email from Matthew. Okay. Textron owns Bell Helicopter and Cessna Aircraft. Oh, there's more, though. Textron also owns the maker of the Shadow M2 UAS. The manufacturer is AAI. A wholly owned.
Those aren't real airplanes.
Those aren't real airplanes.
I'm kidding, and I apologize to
Okay.
Chris.
Let's see. What else? Textron also owns Aerosonde, a business unit of AAI. Aerosonde makes net-recovered unmanned aerial systems that can fly for up to 38 hours. Textron Defense Systems makes the CBU-97 or CBU-105 guided bombs, but I am unsure if that counts as an airframe.
No, that doesn't count. That's like the Lycoming answer.
All right, so we're going to scratch that part of the answer. Okay, so that's it. So we got Bell and Cessna, but the unmanned part of the business, we didn't get that part. So thanks to Matthew for that one. So that's good. No, those are some good questions. All right, so we have some more that we'll hold for next time. Again, if you'd like to send in questions for us, send it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Unless you want me to see the answer, don't put the answer in the email with the question. You could put it in an attachment or send a second email with the subject line of, like, Grill the Geeks answer. Then I won't see it in advance either. Okay, moving on to listener mail. First off, I mean, we did at the beginning, but I just want to say a general thank you to all of our listeners who sent us well wishes for 200 episodes. We really got too many to mention, but they were fantastic to receive, and we shared them with all the guys. And also, we want to thank again, and I think David mentioned this, the art department at Thrombey Air for the amazing cartoon. If you haven't seen that, go to airplanegeeks.com, look at the blog post for episode 200. If you click on the picture on the cartoon, it will open up into a full-size picture, so you can see all the details in there. And everything in that cartoon has some interesting meaning to the Airplane Geeks podcast, so see if you can see how many of those things you can tell what they mean. And I encourage you to check out thrombeyair.com. It's a hilarious site. It's a lot of fun. And you can follow Thrombey on Twitter at Thrombey, T-H-R-O-M-B-Y. All right, we got a letter from Frank. Frank says, in podcast 199, a caller said he saw a plane flying backwards and identified it as a Beechcraft Starship. I think it's more likely to be an Avante, which is featured on the cover of the May Flying Magazine. I have long considered this on my one of my favorite airplanes, and see several of them based at the St. Petersburg Clearwater, Florida airport. The pusher turbo configuration has a very distinctive sound and can be easily recognized. These are popular now due to their fuel efficiency versus a small jet, and there are over 200 flying today. I enjoy your podcast very much. And yeah, the Beechcraft Starship and the, I guess it's the Piaggio P-180 Avante. I mean, they share some sort of some similarities, especially maybe in silhouette.
And I was fortunate enough to hear two of them today fly out of Philadelphia International Airport. And the listener's right. They are... I can tell when one is leaving the airport because they sound really different than anything else out there. So yeah, you could, I hear it first and then I go to the window and say, yep, it's one of the Avantes.
Wow.
So there's one that it was either doing multiple flights into the airport today or there were multiples flying out of it, but I get one on a regular basis. So they're unique.
Now, we got a second email after that, that one from Frank, and we thank Frank for that. A second email from Pat. Pat says, hey, guys, I was just listening to episode 189. I think I can help identify the plane Micah saw on approach to Teterboro. Micah was our listener who sent in the original email on this. But Pat says, I live and fly here in North Jersey in a company called Avantair operates a fleet of Piaggio P-180s out of Essex County and Teterboro airports. From the ground, they look just like the Starship with the twin-engine pusher configuration. They also make a very unique noise and are easy to identify long before they are in view. Hope this helps. Keep up the great work.
Avant Air is the biggest operator, I believe, of the Piaggio in the United States. Ah,
so maybe that's what Micah saw. Either way, either one is pretty cool. I'd be excited to see either one. So you know something about the Avante. Is that a supercritical wing, Martin?
Your guess is as good as mine. I did mention in the notes that one of our emeritus professors is the guy who designed the wing. I can ask him and get back to you.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Okay. The aircraft itself is interesting. And about the Starship, I think the only place you're going to see the Starship in operation nowadays is following Spaceship One and Spaceship Two. The rest of the Starships that were built have been bought back by Beechcraft and destroyed.
Not quite. There's 10 of them on the registry.
Oh.
Yeah.
It was one at Oshkosh last year.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. All right. Well, both planes are awfully interesting. At least I think so. They're pretty cool looking. Let's see. We got an email from Tony. Just read David's article about the Caravelle. Wow, it took me back to when my dad was installing Bloodhound missiles for the Swiss Air Force in the 1960s. I was 11 years old and vividly remember flying the Swissair Sud Aviation SE-210 Caravelle and the Convair 990 Coronado between Manchester, England and Zurich, Switzerland. Tony says, the one thing that springs to mind was the in-flight catering on both types was the hot dog. It consisted of a cold sausage on hot bread. He says, nice. His father passed away a month ago. Sorry to hear that, Tony. He says that he worked for a company called Ferrante Limited, who sent him to Switzerland, Sweden, and various UK Air Force bases to install and test Bloodhound missiles. And my first flight as an 11-year-old was in Ferrante's private aircraft, a de Havilland Heron. Let's see. He says, I remember we landed in Zurich in a blizzard after two or three go-rounds. Let's see. Oh, yeah. He says, Ferrante and the Royal Air Force, the RAF, had a missile test range into the Irish Sea off Aberporth, Wales. And my dad told me about a test that he was present at that went wrong. Oh, this is funny. Well, it could have been disastrous. When a Bloodhound missile was sent downrange, but had a problem with its guidance system and returned to near its launch site and destroyed a car in the parking lot. Fortunately, the missile wasn't carrying a warhead. Even so, the owner of the car wasn't too impressed. When Tony sent this in, I wrote back and said that, if your car is destroyed by a Bloodhound missile, boy, you've got a great story to tell for the rest of your life.
It's one for the bar, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a great story. Let's see. I wanted to mention this. Oh, we heard from Jeff Ackland, who was a guest, many, many episodes ago on the Radial Rocket. You may recall this is an aircraft that uses a nine-cylinder radial engine, which makes always great sounds because radials are cool. But anyway, so there's a press release. They have a new what they call a streamline kit introduction, and what this does is it allows builders to buy some parts directly from suppliers and use some over-the-counter hardware and materials, and so that reduces the kit price or the total price of all the materials for the kit to the builder. So that's an interesting development, and glad to hear that. We wish Jeff and the whole Radial Rocket project great success because it looks and sounds so cool. You like radials, Martin?
I like the way they sound. I don't like their oil consumption.
Yeah, well, there is that.
Yeah, but if they're not consuming oil, you've got a serious problem.
I know that fact. But nothing quite beats the sound of a radial engine on a Saturday afternoon flying over your house.
Yeah. Let's see. Chris sent in some links. Oh, these are very interesting. We'll put these in the show notes. We had talked before about commercial airliners going through stall testing, or pilots of commercial airliners being trained at altitude in stalls. And this, of course, comes about because of the Air France 447 accident. And I think Rob had mentioned that this just wasn't done. You don't take a Boeing or an Airbus a bus and stall it at altitude. But Chris sent us some video. These were Boeing 747-8 testing videos. And one of them is kind of impressive. It shows dragging the tail on the runway to determine the slowest speed that the aircraft will take off. There is, in fact, an induced stall at altitude, and you can see that in the video. And there's a flutter test, and that's one of the videos. The other one he sent is titled "Boeing 747-8F Performs Ultimate Rejected Takeoff." So what they did is they took one of these things, They took the 747-8, the freighter, full fuel load. They took the Goodrich brakes and machined off virtually all of the lining. They loaded up to maximum takeoff weight, rolling down the runway, maximum thrust, 200 miles an hour, and then slam on the brakes. No thrust reversers to help in aid this. And the idea, of course, is to show that in the worst possible case of a rejected takeoff, that this thing could in fact stop. When it came to a stop, no firefighting support was allowed for 5 minutes, because under the test they want to simulate what could happen in a real world environment. And so you've got these glowing hot brakes, shredded tires, and the thing did, it passed the test. I mean, there wasn't a brake fire that erupted or anything like that. But it's just a really impressive video. And so thank Chris he's from Melbourne, Australia, for sending those along. We'll put those in the show notes. Okay, so I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Chris Anderson. You can find some more fascinating information at DIYdrones.com. Chris, of course, is editor-in-chief at Wired Magazine, a fantastic publication, and especially author of the book The Long Tail. If you're at all interested in economics, or if you're an entrepreneur or would-be and want to understand how the money is made these days to an increasing degree, I personally recommend it's a great book. I think you should take a look at that. And we also want to thank Martin Rotler. Martin, thanks for coming on at the last minute. I really appreciate your help. It's good to talk to you again, and we'll have to have you on more often.
Thank you very much. It's good to be in the air conditioning, talking with a bunch of airplane geeks after sitting outside in a 90-degree temperature graduation today.
Yeah, a nice cap to the day.
Yes.
We want to thank our contributors, Graham McCarron and Steve Vischer, from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast. Find them at that same spot. Normally, we'd be thanking Peter Johnson, and hopefully we'll be thanking him next week or pretty soon, and he'll return with his Across the Pond segments. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
Well, should we actually say something about where they can find us live next week, Max?
Oh, that's a good idea. All right. So this is Saturday. We're talking about Saturday, June 16th.
And the Airplane Geeks will be broadcasting live from the Unver Ahazi Center at Dulles Airport for Be a Pilot Day 2012.
We'll at least be recording live, and hopefully we'll be broadcasting live as well. But we'll see. The technology has let us down in the past. So, yeah, we don't know exactly where in the Stephen Udvar Hazy Center at next to Dulles Airport will be. We'll post it online as soon as we know. But you'll be able to find us there. It's a great time. If you're in the Washington, D.C. or Baltimore, or that general area, this is a great event to bring your whole family, actually, and spend a day at the museum, both inside the museum and outside. They bring in many, many aircraft.
50 additional will be there And the forecast, folks, is going to be sunny and 92. So there's going to be no doubt there'll be a lot of airplanes to look at.
Okay. So, David, between now and then, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Google Plus at Plus David Vanderhoof. And you can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
Great. And Martin Rottler.
You can find me on Twitter at Martin Rottler. You can find me on Google Plus, which I'm not using as much, at Martin Rottler. And you can find me on LinkedIn, Martin Rottler. I need to come up with a creative name.
I think Martin Rottler's, and that's with two T's, R-O-T-T-L-E-R.
Yes, two T's, R-O-T-T-L-E-R. And you can find the OSU Aviation Program at aviation.osu.edu.
That's great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, you can check out my 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 201. You'll find links to all the sites that we mentioned in the podcast. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Bonet will give you that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So be sure to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. Be a pilot day next weekend. We hope to see you there.
I could do Mr. Rottler teaches aviation regulations, and that would be a cure for insomnia.
You realize tonight is actually the Max and Martin show.
Well, here's an alternate. He's still recording?
Yeah.
And I'm the spelunking Grant McCarran.
What on earth is that?
When you go down in caves.
Oh. Well, see, you're so much cleverer than me.
Yeah, right. Hey, I'm not the one who knew about those registrations.
Yes, well, actually, I had that one stored up for a long time.
You still knew it.
I still knew it, yes.
You geek.
Thank you very much. Hey, Grant, you know that Rob Mark guy?
Yeah.
Isn't he great?
Mate, I'm impressed every time with the things he says.
You mean like this?
Is Steve Vischer not really just an incredible audio guy? I mean, really. I mean, he is just unbelievable.
Oh, he loves me, Grant. He really loves me.
Mate, the way your ego's been stoked by that comment, I think we could just strap a pair of wings to you and let you fly, because, mate, you're floating.
Jeez, I can't even get my head out of this studio. In fact, I need to get out. Somebody, help. Somebody, help. Bring me food.
Oh, no. Quick, food, stat.
Give me a pizza, stat.
We've had no bloopers either this show.
You know, this show has been surprisingly, of course, Dan is gone, so there goes 50% or maybe 75% of our bloopers. And Rob is not here this episode, so there goes most of the rest of it.
We're at 99.5% blooper free.
That's right. Yeah, I hope that's not too boring for our listeners.